Peter B. Collins. News and comment. Monday, March 12, 2012. Some breaking news here in San Francisco. The soap opera ends as the sheriff takes a plea.
From the heavens, it was easy to tell. It was love from above that could save me from hell. Shed fire in a soul, it was easy to see how the devil himself could be pulled out of me. There were drums in the air as she started to dance. Every soul in the room keeping time with their hands. And we sang, hey-oh.
More on the San Francisco story before the end of this podcast. Our intro music today from Santana with Chad Kroger. It's called Into the Night. And we've got a tragic situation that could fuel further problems for the ongoing U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. As we've pointed out many times before, with support from reporters like Gareth Porter and journalist Anand Gopal, one of the real irritants of the American occupation is night raids, where our forces knock on a door and run through a house, maybe arrest somebody, but they scare the daylights or the nightlights out of people. And this is a tragic event from any point of view. But on Sunday, an American soldier killed 16 people, and he essentially broke into three homes during the night. And most of them were children. He burned some of the bodies. And this is on the heels of the outrage over the Koran burning. And so it makes it very difficult to see how these breaches can be repaired and how the United States can maintain its occupation. I know we're getting mixed signals from the Obama administration and Leon Panetta, Secretary of Defense. But at the same time, they talk about pulling out combat troops next year. There's a deal on the table with the Afghan government to keep foreign forces in the country for another dozen years. And we know that one of the fundamental issues is that the Taliban says they won't negotiate until all foreign forces are out of Afghanistan. This is not only a no-win situation, this is a lose or lose big situation. And we're making it worse. I'm not sure how this plays out, but this is an important incident that may not be remembered for long here on our shores. But I think it will be embedded in the memories of many Afghans for a long time to come. Also out of Afghanistan before that grisly shooting spree, the New York Times reports that there are accusations that the Afghans are using airplanes, including American airplanes, an Afghan Air Force, I don't know what kind of planes they have, to smuggle opium out of Afghanistan, the big cash crop there. And this is fraying American-Afghan relations even further. Here's a quote. The lack of Afghan cooperation in the investigation sharply illustrates what for the U.S. has become an uncomfortable facet of the war in Afghanistan. By continuing to finance and work with an Afghan government and military seen as corrupt at almost all levels, the United States and its allies have helped create a problem they now seem powerless to fix. Also, over the weekend, an agreement was struck to transfer Afghan detainees who are being held at Parwan, the huge prison complex adjacent to the Bagram Air Base, to Afghan custody over the next 6 months. They, of course, had demanded full control of the prison, and this appears to be a compromise position offered by the United States. As I've predicted before, I think there's an Abu Ghraib, I think there's a Guantanamo story ready to break whenever we lose control of Parwan and other facilities near Bagram. Gareth Porter, who I mentioned a moment ago and who has provided great coverage on this program and debunking stories that don't appear to be true, is now examining the Associated Press story that reported last week that the Iranians are trying to clean up Parchin. I know I just said Parwan, so Parchin is a site where we suspect they are conducting nuclear enrichment. And the story was that based on aerial photographs and satellite pictures, that the Iranians were trying to clean up this site in advance of inspections that they have recently agreed to. And Phil Giraldi, who's been on this program before and joined us for Boiling Frogs interviews as well, is quoted in the article. He said a U.S. intelligence official had confirmed to him that the officials in question were not talking about intelligence provided by U.S. agencies. And so this may be a completely fabricated story. Please do exercise skepticism. In a podcast that we'll release over the next couple of days, I had a great conversation with Trita Parsi. He is the author of several books on Iran. You may have caught his appearance on Jon Stewart's Daily Show last week. And he offered up some pretty strong comments about the showdown between Obama and Netanyahu in Washington last week. And he asserts that Obama not only won that struggle, but that the risk of an Israeli military assault on Iran has been pushed from the immediate future to the distant future and may have been nipped in the bud altogether. Listen to these comments from Trita Parsi.
This is a position that the president has taken, not recently, but this has actually been the longstanding position of the Obama administration, knowing very well that the U.S. intelligence says that Iran has not made a decision to build a bomb, nor do they have an active weapons program right now. So while there is a trigger here, the trigger is very, very far down the road, and we may never actually hit it based on the current intelligence. Now, compare that position to the position that the Israeli government wanted to press upon Obama to adopt, which was that it would be unacceptable for Iran to have nuclear capability. Not a nuclear weapon, but to have the capability to build one.
Right.
It's a very vague term. It's not really clear exactly what it means, but it's largely understood to mean that they can't have enrichment. Well, they actually already have enrichment. So with that red line that the Israelis tried to impose on Obama, which he rejected, one could argue that the United States technically should already be at war with Iran if Obama had accepted it. But he didn't. He did not cave on that very, very central point. Now, he did say, of course, that there is a red line, and I think it would have been next to impossible politically not to have done so. And he's putting the red line at weapons, which actually does have legal support in the sense that as a signatory of the non-proliferation treaty, the Iranians are not supposed to build weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So while there's some voices that are concerned that this is putting us in a confrontation with Iran down the road, even though it may have evaded a war in the short term, I'm a bit more optimistic in the sense that I think that that is a red line that is defendable, that is justified, and that actually has put the trigger in a place where I think the Obama administration feels pretty confident the Iranians are actually not going to cross it.
And we'll release the full interview with Trita Parsi in the next day or so at peterbcollins.com. Also, recently on this program, we talked with Joel Brinkley, a former New York Times foreign correspondent who now teaches journalism at Stanford. And in his Sunday column, he refers to the proposed or, threatened Israeli attack on Iran as a stupid idea. He writes, "Despite extraordinary election year pressure, President Obama stood up to Netanyahu last week and refused to be dragged into still another war, this one against Iran. And for that, I admire him, because should Israel's right-wing government make the great mistake of attacking Iran, as some Israeli leaders are tacitly threatening to do, the United States is almost certain to be drawn into the fighting." That's Joel Brinkley, and his column appears on Sundays in the San Francisco Chronicle. Meanwhile, Israel has launched a new round of assaults on the Gaza Strip, and they killed a Palestinian activist and alleged terrorist named Zuhair al-Qaizi, and two of his underlings. They used a drone to strike his car in Gaza City and killed him and two of his associates. It was the highest profile killing that Israel's carried out in many months, and it produced a spate of rocket attacks that have been aimed at Israel. More than 100 have been fired in response, and Israel has continued with follow-up assaults from the air on the Gaza Strip. I hope this does not spin out of control. Also, you may have missed it, but Yemeni military officials said on Saturday that two American airstrikes killed at least 18 al-Qaeda-linked militants in an evening attack. This appears to be last Friday. And, yes, it was Friday evening. 18 militants had been killed. And, of course, we have to take it on faith that these are actually al-Qaeda terrorists. That is what we're told. But we rarely see any proof of such activities. The New York Times had several powerful editorials in Sunday's paper. And in particular, one of the issues that I've been ranting and raving about here, which was the targeted killing of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen, in Yemen, the recent justifications of it by the Attorney General, Eric Holder, the lack of process, the lack of public disclosure of the basis on which these decisions are made to kill people, and who actually makes these decisions. In an alleged democracy, I believe we are entitled to know. And in criticizing Attorney General Holder, the Times said that he agreed that killing an American citizen requires that he poses an imminent threat of violent attack against the United States, that capture is not feasible, that the target has military value, that other people are not targeted intentionally, and that the potential collateral damage not be excessive, and that the weapons used will not inflict unnecessary suffering. But Holder refuses to even confirm that there is a memo from the Office of Special Counsel that offers a legal basis for this unconstitutional action on the part of the President of the United States, in cahoots with his Attorney General. And so I am pleased to hear the Times weighing in on this. We need to hear far more voices about that. We've also been talking recently about the law that drew almost no notice. It's named the Federal Restricted Buildings and Grounds Improvement Act, also known as the Anti-Occupy Bill. It drew notice in Monday's Wall Street Journal. And it's about time. We've been talking about this for a week now, and I have seen zero coverage in the corporate media, on television, in print. And I can't read everything, so certainly there may have been coverage that I missed, but I do try to keep tabs. And the article in the Wall Street Journal points out that this is really the fine-tuning of a 1971 trespass law, and it is explicit. It says that it is an offense to knowingly enter a restricted area, including the White House or its grounds, or the Vice President's official residence or its grounds, a building or grounds where the President or other person protected by the Secret Service is or will be temporarily visiting, or a building or grounds so restricted due to a special event of national significance. Now, that third means that you can declare any space, including government property that is nominally public, to be restricted. And to clear up some confusion, the bill originally passed the House a year ago, in February of 2011. And then it was passed on February 6th this year, I believe with no dissenting votes in the Senate. There were three in opposition in the House last year. Ron Paul was one of them. And then the president signed this bill into law last week on March 8th. And it was sponsored by Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, who said it will improve the law enforcement tools available to the Secret Service in attempts to protect the president, the vice president, and others on a day-to-day basis. No, it will restrict free speech rights. And that is unconstitutional, and nobody seems to be upset by it. Chris Hedges has a great piece that you can find at truthdig.com. And again, it relates to our constitutional rights. And he focuses on the likelihood that the United States Supreme Court will endorse President Obama's attacks on whistleblowers, starting with Bradley Manning, the WikiLeaks case, but also related to Kiriakou at the CIA. And that's old. That's a case from back in 2007. Kiriakou was charged with exposing secrets about waterboarding. And Bush didn't prosecute him, but Obama is. And there are other cases as well that we have discussed on this program, including the plea bargain of Thomas Drake at the National Security Agency, who was not only trying to protect our constitutional rights, but was trying to save the government $1 billion fricking dollars. But they prosecuted him, and he folded and pled guilty to a silly charge of misuse of a government computer just to get the case to go away. Also, the Times has a great editorial, and I also want to connect that to an excellent piece of enterprise journalism that appeared in my Sunday San Francisco Chronicle under the byline of business reporter Kathleen Pender. And both the Times editorial and Pender's article detail that Democrats went along with Republicans last week in passing what's called the JOBS bill. And as I commented at the time, the most interesting thing was that the gridlock in Washington eased as Democrats held their noses and voted for what is actually a collection of six different bills. And the JOBS, Jumpstart Our Business Startup Act, actually loosens some of the rules that were enacted in the financial reform that Elizabeth Warren was supposed to head up, but they brought in the guy from Ohio on the recess appointment. And the watering down of Dodd-Frank, according to this journalist, who I think has really anticipated what can happen here, will allow companies that are in startup mode to raise capital from strangers over the internet. And this reduces the regulation for what are called qualified investors who can participate in startup investments and other high-risk vehicles. And so, even as the Democrats say that the weak Dodd-Frank bill cleaned up the problems on Wall Street without, of course, taking us back to the Glass-Steagall Act, which really was a firewall between investment banks and depositor banks. No, we never went there, never even got close. But the limited gains achieved under Dodd-Frank are now being undermined. Democrats are supporting it, and we know that lobbyists have been working hard to limit the impact of other aspects of the Dodd-Frank law. Also, the San Francisco Chronicle had another great enterprise story about the role of Silicon Valley firms in internet censorship and other surveillance conducted by the government of China. And in particular, the collusion of Cisco Systems that makes network routers and other connectivity devices in cracking down, in helping the Communist Party of China crack down on the Falun Gong religious sect. And this goes back 10, 12 years to 1999. But an interesting sidebar here, James Temple, who wrote this article, notes that there are other companies that are active in helping crack down on popular expression and uprisings. A quick couple of examples. Blue Coat Systems of Sunnyvale in Silicon Valley acknowledged that Syria had been using more than a dozen of its devices to censor web activity. It also has provided the same technology to Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and other nations. At a recent trade show, NetOptics of Santa Clara highlighted a case study in which it helped a major mobile operator in China analyze criminal activity and detect and filter undesirable content on cell phones. McAfee, the company that sells virus protection, and I fear they actually make the viruses, but I don't know, they were recently acquired by Intel. They provide filtering software for ISPs in Bahrain, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia. Hewlett-Packard has reportedly sold their equipment to computer operators in Syria as part of a surveillance system used to monitor emails and internet use. So isn't it nice to know that the high-tech companies in Silicon Valley will sell their gear to any repressive regime? Yeah, doesn't bother them. And finally, the story that we started with, and this one is a little bit personal to me. As I've explained before, Ross Mercurimi was elected sheriff of the city and county of San Francisco last November. And Ross is a guy I've known for 20 years, and he initially invited me to work on his campaign. It didn't happen. I did not work on his campaign, but he won. And then on New Year's Eve, he got into a fight with his wife, Ileana Lopez, a former star of telenovelas, soap operas in Venezuela. And it's been quite a soap opera ever since. The wife went to see a neighbor who graduated from law school but is not a practicing lawyer. The neighbor took a videotape of a bruise on the sheriff's wife's arm, which she says was caused by him in the argument that they had. Well, after many legal skirmishes, it became clear that the courts would permit this video to be entered into evidence. And so, over the weekend, Mercurimi negotiated a plea deal. And on Monday morning, he pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charge of false imprisonment when he grabbed his wife. They dropped a domestic violence charge and two other misdemeanor counts. And so Mercurimi hopes that this will put this case to rest. There is the possibility of an ethics investigation that the mayor of San Francisco could launch, but it makes Mercurimi's former colleagues on the Board of Supervisors, the city council, his judge and jury. And it seems unlikely that that process will be pursued. And depending on what kind of firestorm erupts after this plea deal, I believe that it's Mercurimi's intention to hold on to his job as sheriff and hope that this never surfaces again. But because he mishandled this in so many different ways, and because an old girlfriend surfaced who claimed that he had been, you know, he rough-handled her on one or two occasions, it's not clear that this plea deal will make the case go away in the so-called court of public opinion. So we'll be watching this carefully, and at least this episode of the Mercurimi Lopez telenovela is over for now. Thanks for listening to today's news and comment. This is a free podcast. Feel free to post it on Facebook or send it to a friend. And thanks for listening. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you. Until we meet again, happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.